Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. Parents can send instant money transfers, automate allowance, and more. Plus, keep an eye on spending with real-time notifications. Join more than 6 million families building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey. That's greenlight.com/odyssey.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producers are Patrick Antonetti and Sean Cherry. Our guest this week is one of our regulars. John Orand is the Sports Business Daily's media writer, and you can find his excellent work on there. If you happen to be on Twitter, follow him at Orand underscore SBJ, O-U-R-A-N-D underscore SBJ, one of the essential follows when it comes to sports media. And John Orand joins us on the Sports Media Podcast. John, welcome back.
Thanks, man. Always good to come on.
The America's favorite sports media podcast guest, so I appreciate you coming on, as always.
I have a busy schedule, yeah.
No doubt. All right, so let's. We're taping this on Friday, April 24th. So it's one night. It's one day after the first night of the NFL draft. So if you listen to this, most likely the draft will have been concluded by then. So just so it gives you a little bit of context as to when John and I are talking. All right, John. Before we get to viewership or anything like that, I want to talk to you about production. How did you view the first night of the NFL draft? I must say, John, I was incredibly impressed by just the technical aspirations and the ability to pull off what was probably the most complicated draft ESPN and the NFL Network had ever done. Essentially, very, very minor technical glitches. Kind of amazing.
Yeah, and you know, I was watching for the glitches. I mean, I think that's part of the ethos of being a reporter. Like, what's going to go wrong? I can't wait to see it, and I want to see how they react from the glitches. And I think that you can really quibble about certain things or certain delays that a couple of analysts had when they started to speak. Goodell several times didn't realize that he was on camera and was heard doing different things. So there were things that happened that, if they had happened on an enclosed set, would have been, you know, worthy of note and bashing. But that was a technical marvel as far as I was concerned. I mean, the way they were able to sort of seamlessly talk to people in so many different areas, and I'm just going to point to, I have on my screen right now a tweet from Fred Godelli of Sunday Night Football, who said, congratulations to the production and engineering staffs of ESPN and NFL Network. In a normal year, the draft is a monster. To do it in this environment is a tremendous achievement of the highest order, and I couldn't agree more. I mean, there were no big glitches, and the small glitches there were just were really pretty insignificant.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think so. We'll take sort of a couple different things from the telecast and give it a little bit of analysis. The first thing, John, on that was, you know, my sense would have been that the Goodell part would have been good. I feel like Roger Goodell is going to have as much IT people in his office, his home office, to make sure that works well. Where I was really surprised at just how smooth it was the six different analysts that they had, you know, Kurt Warner, Michael Irvin, Daniel Jeremiah, et cetera, Kuiper, obviously, Louis Riddick. That was seamless, John. Those guys were all in different places. Some of them had never worked together before. And I was really, really impressed by the fact that, you know, was it as good as if everybody was in the exact same studio? No, but it wasn't so far off that. So that's first and foremost. That I was really impressed by just how well that worked.
Yeah, and let me add on to that too, because you were watching ESPN or NFL Network. I was watching last night on ABC, and they had a completely different roster of talent there. They had, you know, Rinaldi hosting, Herb Street, Jesse Palmer, Desmond Howard, Maria Taylor. And it was the same thing. It was just a very, I mean, you didn't have verbal clues, so it wasn't as seamless, but it was very quick, and it was, you know, it was broadcast TV worthy. It was really a technical feat.
I did flip between both broadcasts. I did mostly watch the ESPN NFL Network broadcast. I did flip to the ABC at times. And the one thing about the ABC broadcast, John, is it makes it very, you know, it's intentional, where it's much more college focused, and they want to do the backstories of these athletes to sort of give you much more perspective on their story, as opposed to how will said athlete fit, you know, in Tampa Bay's defensive scheme. Do you have a preference, just a personal preference, as to what you think works better in terms of just a sort of a content philosophy when it comes to presenting the draft?
You know, I just want to say, before saying anything, this is the most positive I think you and I have ever been on this podcast. So if we don't get stories from Reith Miller and LaPlaca, then we're doing something wrong, Richard. This is crazy.
So it's early. It's John. It's early in the podcast.
All right. Give it time. Give it time. Look, I like the ABC broadcast. It's something that I can sit down with my daughters and watch. And it's set up so it doesn't get into the X's and O's. If you're a hardcore, not even hardcore, if you're a big sports fan, or if you're an NFL fan, you're going to want to watch ESPN. If you're not so much an NFL fan, but you want to see a big event, which the draft has turned into, you want to see those backstories. I mean, this is it is broadcast TV 101. Dick Ebersol did this for years with the Olympics and all the soft features behind, so that you get to know these athletes before they compete. And that's exactly the blueprint that, you know, ABC has been trying to use on its show. So if you don't, you know, it's funny that they did have all the college people in there. If you don't know college all that well, that is a great way to get introduced to these athletes.
John, I want to ask you one question just about the draft itself, the fact that it is existing and being broadcast. You know, I have great admiration for the people who were working behind the scenes at ESPN last night. Let me be very clear. No, they're not first responders. No, they're not nurses. No, they're not doctors, nor should they even be considered in the same sort of conversation when describing what they did last night. That said, these are people working in conditions they've never worked under before. They're wearing masks. They're working in close quarters in a building with others where, you know, you cannot guarantee, you know, unless you have the kind of system where you're checking temperature, you're getting tested, you know, unless you're sort of set up like South Korea, you can't guarantee that you're walking into a totally clean facility. But these guys worked it, and obviously they did a masterful job. But there's a real question to that, John. And the question is, if there is even any kind of risk, however small, to employees, should this thing even be on? And again, I don't want to be a hypocrite here. I'm glad it was on. I watched it. And obviously, if I'm writing about it, you know, I must in some sense support that it's on. That said, I think that's a fair question. And there were certainly some people on social media who asked me that, like, if it's such a risk, why do it? Where do you stand on this?
Yeah, I'm wondering, and I don't know the answer to this, maybe you do, if I am a behind-the-scenes producer and I wanted to beg out because I didn't feel safe, I can't imagine ESPN would have said, no, you have to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. In talking to Seth Markman, he said, at least publicly for the record, that any employee who did not want to work the draft did not have to.
Well, in Georgia now, a nail salon is an essential business, I suppose. I would suggest that that's the most political I've ever gotten on this pod, Richard, right there.
True. So I'm stunned by that, John. I almost fell off my chair.
You were stunned into silence. Look, I think that ESPN is a 24/7 network, as is Fox, as is CBS. They are there to produce television. I think that the television, when we see the numbers that come out, and my prediction before going in was over 16 million. I bet I wouldn't be surprised if it went over 20 million. To be perfectly frank, I mean, is that an essential service? You know, I don't know. It's pretty close. You're entertaining 20 million people who are quarantined at home. I think that it's, you know, what you brought up is something that to be honest, never even entered my mind. I mean, it's sort of what is happening across the television landscape. It's not unique to ESPN. I mean, at Lifetime Television, you know, they're having the same discussions, I'm sure, going in. So, if you wanted to beg out because you weren't safe, I would imagine they would have let you do that. But I didn't have any problem with what was going on.
Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending with real-time notifications. Kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. And parents can rest easy knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
John, by the time people listen to this, the viewership numbers are going to be out. As we're taping this now, the only thing that's out is reporting by you. You got some overnight numbers from selected big markets, New York, Chicago, Philly, and Boston. Man, I mean, Boston up 52% from last year, Philly up 52% from last year, Chicago up 38% from last year, New York 13% from last year. I mean, generally, John, if the draft's not held in these cities, you know, the big cities, it's usually the Birminghams and the Norfolks and the Nashvilles and the Raleigh-Durhams where, like, you see these monster, sort of shares. But I think you're right, man. I think my prediction as to what the draft was going to be, and I thought it would be around 14, 15 million. I think I may be low here. The early indications based on your reporting seem to suggest that this was a monster viewership last night.
Yeah, and you and I both know it's impossible to take an overnight number and guess at what the final number is going to be. But you can take a look at New York, the biggest market in the States, Chicago, the third biggest market in the States. I think Philly is the fourth or fifth biggest market in the States, and they're up 13%, 38%, 52%. It's going to be a massive number, and I think that you know, this is a prediction rather than sort of taking a look at that, but it's going to be an all-time high by a mile, I think.
Now, this will be sort of, we'll see if we turn out to be right or not. Do you think this, again, day two and day three are never close to day one, but do you think the trend continues? Do you think we're going to see massive increases for day two versus previous year's day two? Do you think we'll see massive increases for day three off previous years for day three?
I don't know. One of my quibbles, so a couple of quibbles that I have with last night is that was there really a storyline that hooked you that made you want to stay to the end, or maybe a storyline that
made really.
You want? And
no.
I think that the draft was sort of missing that a little bit. And also, if I want to make another quibble, and this is a TV quibble, I went to bed. I fully admit before the first round ended. I think that it ended at 12:15 or so. It ended after midnight at some point. With everybody, the idea of starting later is what they've done in TV for decades because you want to get the West Coast viewership in and everybody, you want people to come home from work and sit down and start to watch. But everybody, or not everybody, but a huge majority of the country, including all of California, is quarantined in the house. Why wouldn't they start this at, say, 7 p.m. Eastern, where you know, you're not worried about people that are stuck in traffic in L.A. trying to get home because they're already home? And then you don't have to run into the problem where it ends after midnight, which is too late for, you know, look, my team had already picked, so I don't need to stick that late. You know, that's something that I wonder if they thought about beforehand, and it's something that I wonder if they would do over if they had the chance.
Yeah, but John, you know that historically, all these networks want this to be pushed as late as possible. I get that it ended around, I watched the whole draft, I think it ended a little after midnight Eastern, but you know, there's a reason why World Series games start when they do. There's a reason why the NBA final starts when it does. The data will tell you that the later in the night, you know, until you get to the point of no return, you're always going to draw better than if you start at 7 o'clock Eastern, 4 o'clock Pacific.
Oh, of course. Of course, that's right. Traditionally and historically, We're in this weird time, though, where people are just home. And I would imagine at 4 p.m. when you're stuck in the house and something's and all of a sudden, you know, something pops up on television that you want to watch, a big event, you know, you're going to tune into it because you're at home with a TV and you don't have to commute and you're not stuck in the office. And so this is like, I'm not advocating for, you know, having World Series games start at 7 p.m., although that would help me and my East Coast residents. I'm just saying, given where we are with coronavirus and given the state of the country right now, I think it would have made more sense to start this earlier and keep everybody from I wonder how many East Coasters went to bed before midnight because they just got tired of it.
Interesting. Yeah, I still would have started later, but that's worth a discussion, at least in terms of, you know, the hypotheticals as to what it may or may not have done. Anything else you want to sort of focus on with the NFL draft? I think you make a great point, though, in that, you know, the most memorable drafts, and usually this is tied to viewership too, John, is someone very well known slipping down. That's usually what Tebow, Manziel, Brady Quinn a little bit. Usually the when somebody is in the green room and they're in the green room forever, that becomes the drama of the draft. You know, you had the Laramie Tunsil stuff a couple of years ago, but this one, you know, other than, you know, maybe a team moving up, maybe a player moving up on draft boards that the draft experts did not exist, pretty stock draft, right? No drama.
Yeah, and if I have any pet peeves, they did, how long did it take for the first pick to come out? I think it was like 8:27.
Took a while.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So let's get to it. We've been waiting for this moment, and then we have to wait another 27 minutes. And then my pet peeve every year, what took the Bengals 10 minutes to make that pick? They knew exactly that it should have taken them 10 seconds. It drives me batty. Other than that, what a great telecast. The numbers are going to be huge. I'm sure the numbers are going to be big throughout the weekend. And it was really minor quibbles that I'm coming out with here.
Maybe the Bengals were thinking about Chase Young. Who
knows? Well, the Redskins are another one. They knew they were taking Chase Young, and then, so we had to wait 20 minutes for the first two picks, and everybody knew it was going to go like that.
Yeah, I could live with the Bengals sort of giving you a little bit of the drama, but the Redskins have no.
Yeah, sense. Come on, guys.
That was the obvious pick of the draft.
I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect for real.
All right, well, let's sort of move on to a couple different things. The Last Dance, John, was both a critical success and a viewership success for its first two episodes. I mean, 6.1 million for a doc, that's incredible numbers. I know everybody on Twitter was excited about it, and people were thinking this is going to get Super Bowl numbers. It never works that way. But 6.1 million viewers for their debut blows away all ESPN 30 for 30 docs. The reviews of this doc, by and large, incredibly positive. This, John, for ESPN, and obviously the partners too, Netflix, etc., at least at this moment, a runaway positive story for them, right?
Yeah, and making it even more positive, a quick shout out to Connor Schell on this. I mean, if they had waited until July 4th weekend, my opinion is, without a coronavirus in a normal sports universe, there's no way they get close to 6 million. They saw the demand they saw the people were just thirsting for some sort of new content that pertained to sports that is not necessarily like an old game or you know, going back too far, even though these are old highlights. And they capitalize on what the draft capitalized on, which is people that are, you know, stuck at home just wanting to be entertained. And they now have, you know, spread across 5 weeks, you know, 2 hours a night of you know, old footage, but old footage presented in a different way and telling a story that, I mean, this is a 30 for 30 that blew away. It's not technically a 30 for 30, I guess, but that blew away any of the other doc numbers. And I just think ESPN was really smart at trying to rush this thing out, even though I'm sure the people making it wanted more time to you know, gloss over some of the little glitches that appear in the film.
Yeah, the only, you know, I heard this from not many quarters and some, you know, the only sort of criticism of The Last Dance is it too much of, you know, does it whitewash too much of Jordan? Is it too hagiography? But here's my counter to that. ESPN never promised this to be some unfettered documentary that has never been told of Michael Jordan. It's the real Michael Jordan story. Michael Jordan's production team is a producing partner in this. So it's, you know, of course Jordan's people had involvement in this. They literally are a production partner. The project doesn't get done without Jordan. I think within those confines, it's really, really well done. And I think Jordan gives you incredible insight. But, you know, no one is saying that this is, you know, Icarus or, you know, or a documentary where you're like, you know, going to blow up the underground Russian state-sponsored doping. That's just not realistic. There was no chance that was going to happen. So I think within what it is, I think it's really well done. That's my read on it.
Yeah, this is a positive story for Michael Jordan. I would imagine Michael Jordan has to be thrilled to get this out as it sort of helps his reputation as, you know, the greatest of all time, and just shows how dominant he was during the really what was the heyday of the NBA back in the mid 90s. But I will tell you that Doc does get into you know, his gambling addiction. The Doc gets into, you know, when he just retired and went to baseball and some of the rumors that went around from that. The Doc does at the end of the series, I mean, the Doc does portray Jordan as he was a competitor and he was a winner, but, you know, he was also an asshole and to his player, to his teammates and everybody else. And it doesn't necessarily gloss over that as well. I mean, it's not a complete warts and all. It's not done independently, but it's hardly just kind of like all positive news and ignoring all the negative aspects of what he had to live through.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's well said. It's not a puff piece, and at the same time, it's not a complete portrait, which is fine. I think I have no problem bashing ESPN on things that sort of they do that sucks. But like on this one, they didn't promise you that. They never promised you the Michael Jordan you never knew. They promised you a documentary on the 97-98 Bulls and then give you a sense of who these people were. And I'm with you. I actually was pretty stunned that Jordan went as far as he did on the gambling stuff. And then you as a viewer can make your determination as to what his answers mean. But I certainly recommend it.
If I have one complaint about it, and it's always hard to compare it to an Oscar winning documentary, but you know, the OJ doc, when it came out, was so well done, and it didn't tell it wasn't a story of OJ's trial. It was a story of Los Angeles, and it was a story of the 1990s, and it was a story of, you know, race, and it went in so many different areas. And so my hope when I started to watch The Last Dance was that this would go beyond sort of basketball or go beyond the Chicago Bulls and sort of be one of those. And it doesn't. So this to me is sort of like a really good 30 for 30, but it doesn't quite reach up to what I thought really one of the best, probably the best sports documentary that I've seen, which is the OJ doc. It doesn't really come close to that, but it's eminently watchable, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, to me, I would say like the OJ doc, I think that's, I would argue, probably the greatest sports documentary in history. It's OJ Simpson's story is in some sense the story of America. It's just a much broader story with so many societal, political elements to it, where Jordan has some of that, John, but I don't know if you could tell the same story. I don't think they represent the same things when it comes to documentary filmmaking. That said, and as I wrote, the OJ documentary stands on its own. That's that ambition and that storytelling is at another level than The Last Dance. But I think if you just take The Last Dance on its own, I think it's really well done and would belong in the best 30 for 30s ESPN has ever done. So I'm with you on that. I just think I don't think you can compare the OJ doc to essentially almost anything in sports.
Yeah, it is a harsh comparison, but it's what I was hoping for before I sat down to watch.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Ezra Edelman, who did the OJ doc, I mean, there's a reason a sports documentary on ESPN won an Oscar. You know, it's just that extraordinary thing. But yeah, I hear your point. It's interesting.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
All right, a couple more things here, John. We're pretty early in this to sort of make large pronouncements, but it's what's very clear about what's going on with COVID-19 is there are going to be so many parts of the sports media business that don't necessarily come back. Jobs that are lost are not coming back. You know, if you want to sort of think about like the networks, they've lost revenue that might not come back. A lot of times that obviously floats down to people losing their jobs. You have any sort of large scale thoughts as to what the macro, the sports media business might look like January 2021 after, knock on wood, we get back to work and come out of this?
Yeah. Two things I'm looking at. One is, you know, the first, 15, 20 minutes of this pod, we're talking about the NFL draft and how unique it was and what a technological marvel it is. Well, what these networks are figuring out how to do is produce remotely. And so a lot of these behind-the-scenes folks that are, you know, have spent, you know, decades in production trucks sitting right outside of a stadium, you know, I think TV networks are learning how to produce without needing that. I'm not sure exactly what that means. I'm not sure if it means that they're going to need less bodies. It certainly means less travel. Certainly means less people staying in, like, you know, the Four Seasons in DC or whatever, as they, you know, come to shoot, games here. But that's something that I'm looking at, because I think that had already been happening. We had heard about, even down to ESPN having their play-by-play and analysts, you know, calling games from Bristol. I mean, I think that's been a slow-moving trend, and I'm thinking if I were betting, I would bet that this is going to accelerate that a whole lot more. And I'm not entirely certain what that means or who might be affected.
I agree with that. I think you're going to see less remote productions and more productions from the Bristol studio or from the Fox's Los Angeles studio. John, I know that you've been a longtime fan of Sports Illustrated. I think everybody listening to this podcast knows I worked there for nearly two decades. What's your sort of just initial reaction to see, once again, another round of layoffs from the Maven, and then very, very recently, Grant Wall, no longer with the Maven as well?
Yeah, that's hard. I don't want to single out Sports Illustrated completely, because everybody sees what's going on with the ad market, and it's affecting online ads, it's affecting television ads, and it's certainly affecting print ads. And it's, you know, these are tough times right now for really anybody that's dependent on you know, the public or an ad supported business, and SI sort of falls right in that. But you know, that the thing that I do want to take a swipe at the Maven and Sports Illustrated for is, you know, how long had Grant Brent been at SI?
Maybe in the 20-year range, something like that. Maybe a little more. 24 years. 24 years, actually, now that I think about it, yeah.
A 24-year reporter that is, you know, that you end up getting rid of, you know, and people make decisions all the time. But then they not only have to kick him on the way out, but publicize his salary. And it was just shocking that that management thought that they could win some sort of PR war by doing that. And it makes me think that when the Maven comes after other reporters, when this lifts, people are going to remember that, and it's going to be Confederate money, you know, like I don't know how long it's going to happen before you turn on me, and then you're going to put me out on social media and publications, let people know my salary, let people know like my inner workings and what I did. Like it management doesn't do that. That really shocked me and disgusted me and made me think that the Maven is not a very good place for reporters to work.
Yeah, it's well said. I will say this, no matter what you think of Grant Wall putting out initially sort of his concerns about the Maven wanting him to take a pay cut, but it wasn't just a pay cut. Maven wanted him to take a pay cut and Grant's belief that pay cut would be permanent. A management group that tries to publicly tarnish and embarrass a guy by throwing his salary out there, that's as disgraceful as it gets for the management of a media company. And again, and this is not anything I haven't said before, if you are a reporter or writer currently working there or currently in the business looking at working at a place like that, how on earth could you ever trust that management again? You've literally seen what they've done publicly to, as you said, John, a long-tenured reporter. It also gets to the whole fact that the whole notion that these guys put out there saying that, you know, SI was broken and we're here to fix Sports Illustrated and we're here to create, we're here to get the best parts of its DNA and modernize is all bullshit. That's just, you know, look at the product now. That's not the case. And it's hard for me to say because there's still a lot of people who work there who I worked with. There's some great talent there, but they're systematically destroying the last of Sports Illustrated, and it's really hard to see.
Yeah, and if you parse my words, you notice I didn't support what Grant did, and I think that if I were giving Grant advice, I would have said, Grant, you don't want to go public with this. And I will even go out and say, like, I think that Grant was probably wrong in being public with that. But to have management do what it did is all I can say is I wouldn't want to work for that type of company.
Let's finish up on this, John. This was a tweet that you sent out, and I thought I was glad to see you do it because I'm aware of this as well, and I've been reading these people. But we are seeing amid COVID-19 a lot of sports writers in North America morph from their sports writing jobs to covering news. Kent Babb is the one of the Washington Post that you cited. I'm in Toronto, so Bruce Arthur and some other Toronto Star, Canada-based sports writers have morphed over to the news side during this. And the one thing, John, that I think it shows is that the really skilled sports writers in North America can cover a news story as well as news writers, and oftentimes because they're really used to they're used to a certain deadline or they're used to a certain style of writing, they probably are writing some pieces that can be transcendent just because, you know, sports writing a lot of times gives you the freedom to do some interesting and creative things where sometimes the news side doesn't. So I took note of that, and I thought that was interesting. And we've seen this before, you know, Isabella Krishoutian, who was the Capitals beat writer, is now one of the reporters in Moscow for the Washington Post. And another one, too, has been on this podcast, Chelsea Janes, who covered the Washington Nationals for a while, is, you know, initially covered the Kamala Harris campaign and now is doing other political stuff. And Chico Harlan, somebody, John, you may know, was a Nationals writer who is the Rome bureau chief at the Washington Post covering the COVID-19 story in Italy. So this is not an uncommon thing, and these people are producing some great work.
Yeah, and I singled out Ken Babb, but, you know, the Washington Post is down to, you know, 3 pages in its print edition devoted to sports. There are no games that are happening. And they have Robert Klemko is also doing it, a few other people. I don't know if you remember Alex Putterman, who used to be at Awful Announcing. He is now covering COVID for a Connecticut paper.
Hartford Current.
Thank you very much. And there aren't games to cover anymore, but there is. There are a billion stories about the pandemic, and it's not unique to the Post. But you know, I happen to live in D.C., so I notice it more with them. They are out there, and their stories are really, really good, which is not a shock to me. But it was something that. That I tweeted, and I was surprised that that tweet got as much activity as it did, with a lot of other newspaper people saying, highlighting their reporters as well, and a lot of people mentioning what you mentioned about sports reporters that are able to, you know, really cover anything. And I also think it's partly, you know, my first job in journalism, I was covering county planning board meetings in Montgomery County, Maryland, and somehow you had to sit through these, you know, 3, 4, 5 hour meetings and come out with a story that is interesting and makes sense, which I'm not going to say I did all the time, but you know, there's a certain discipline that you learn and get to, that really affects all journalists, not just sports journalists, but that they're able to apply that to COVID.
Yeah. Send me some of those clips, John, from your first job. I'd like to read those county.
You could only build in certain areas of Montgomery County, Maryland. You can only build your fence a certain height, and every now and then there would be people that wanted it to be over 6 feet. It would be 8 feet, those were always the best.
Yeah, I will say this. There's a lot of horrible things about Twitter, to be honest. But one of the horrible ones is you can say something that's praising someone, like basically saying, "I'm really impressed by this. Like, this person's doing a good job." And inevitably, at some point, someone will weigh in and say, "Yeah, but." Why didn't you praise this person too? Or why didn't you? It's like unbelievable. So like in itself, that's, you know, these sports writers who are doing that are doing phenomenal, phenomenal work. It doesn't mean that like others aren't doing phenomenal work. It's just highlighting that, you know, tip your hat to these people who've sort of morphed into this world and are really providing important stories. John, is there anything else you want to add before I let you go? You've been gracious enough to come on post draft, and I appreciate it.
No. I'm just looking forward to tonight and tomorrow night on ESPN, and I think it's on ABC as well. But
all right, John, we made it through a whole podcast. Not a lot of PR drops today. I'm proud of us. You know, I'm sure in the time we did this podcast, somebody leaked to somebody, but otherwise, we've done a good job here.
Yeah, you know what? And we agreed more often than we didn't, and we were positive on a lot of aspects. It was a completely weird pod for me. Richard,
it's a new podcast, a new day. All right, John Orand is the Sports Business Daily and Sports Business Journal media writer. Check out his work for that excellent publication, as well as finding his work on Twitter and other places. John, thank you very much. I'm sure we will talk soon, and wish you and your family nothing but the best of health, and stay safe.
Stay safe, Artie.
All right, back in the studio, not really in the studio, back in my house. My thanks to John Orand for coming on and giving us a little bit of sports media talk. I appreciate that very much. Last couple of podcasts, just so you guys are aware, Sean McDonough came on, was really, really interesting. Talked about sort of what he's doing now and his time at Monday Night Football, which in particular was really, really interesting. He was pretty honest about that. I'm with Sean in that I don't think he got a real fair long shake there. Kalen Kaler and Joe Neeson, both having worked previously at Sports Illustrated, the Maven, and their experiences there, that's worth checking out. Before that, did a Sports Media in the Age of Coronavirus podcast with Ben Strauss of the Washington Post. Prior to that, Chico Harlan, Rome Bureau Chief of the Washington Post, what it's like to cover COVID-19 in Rome. Prior to that, Scott Van Pelt of ESPN. And then prior to that, mentioned on this podcast, Dr. Celine Gounder and Grant Wall. They are married. Celine Gounder is one of the foremost infectious disease experts in the country. Head to any of the archives if you want to check the stuff out that we've done. Please leave us a review. It's basically how the podcast continues. And if you like it, drop 5 stars. Like I said, that's sort of how things continue. Want to thank Patrick and Sean for producing this podcast. Thanks to Chris Corcoran, Spencer Brown, John McDermott at Cadence 13, and everybody out there listening, be healthy and stay safe.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.